Okay, this is a tape of Charlotte Stern from the years in Seattle to, what years is it now?
I think
Seattle.
Through the 30s.
Through the 30s. So it's the 20s through the 30s.
Yes.
All right. What we are doing is recording her tape and erasing the parts that we don't want.
Including the additional material.
And including additional material.
Several things.
Okay.
I mentioned.
I think the Morgan papers came later, 37.
Morgan.
Now,
Lewis Morgan.
We're on the job. Oh, I know that he, Alvin Johnson.
Yes.
So you'll have to repeat
yes,
the students.
Yes.
Right.
In the absence of Bernard, the students, assuming that he had been fired, as of September 1930, initiated a big movement in which hundreds of students were on the campus, holding meetings and protesting his dismissal. At this time, Marion Hathaway, who remained in Seattle, reported to us that the anger of the students and some of the faculty, not many, was so great that the administration of the university called some of them in to ask them what they want and to tell them that he had had another year, that he was not dismissed at that time. We then wrote to one of the student leaders and told him that he had been given a year, but it was clear that he would be out at the end of that year, and so he took advantage of an opportunity to get work as an editor of the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences with Alvin Johnson, and therefore would not be coming back, and that whatever they would do, he would prove and appreciate, but that they should understand that it was a problem of getting something, getting work, which was equally interesting and fascinating to him as a teacher. So the students didn't give up on that, and they insisted upon it. They said that the university administration was reactionary, that they didn't allow, that they were opposed to teachers' unions, they were opposed to student activities, and that the time had come when they have to assert themselves, and that they insisted upon having a trial to find out exactly why Stern had been dismissed. They did not believe it was due to the economic situation and the fact that the university didn't have any funds. Subsequently, there was an open hearing called by the administration at which Marion Hathaway was the only one who testified in behalf of Bernard. The others were very noncommittal, those who were called. But the students made a very valiant fight, and the university, of course, was now in a situation where they didn't have to worry too much because Bernard wasn't coming back anyway. I mean, he didn't want to come back. So the matter, after a while, was resolved by giving the students what they wanted, a hearing. It was all very adequately reported in the Washington Press, and the students kept us informed.
Were these students that he'd made radical?
These were, yes, many of these students that he had influenced tremendously. And subsequently, one of the leading students in this drive, a young man by the name of Don Wakefield, came to New York with his wife and later became one of the editors of the Daily Worker.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a cannery owner, and he didn't want to go back to, he didn't want to work in the canneries, he didn't want to inherit his father's business. But he, after working for 4 or 5 years here in New York, he finally went back, and I understand now that he is one of the big employers of the canneries. changes mind. But there were a great many students of this sort who came to New York to stay, to be with us, and then they went elsewhere.
And you didn't mind moving back to New York?
I didn't, because, first of all, I had no choice, and secondly, I was glad for Burnett's sake that he had this opportunity to be an editor of the Science Encyclopedia. He loved writing, and he loved editing, and he loved research, and it was an ideal position for him. He enjoyed every minute of it, and it brought him in contact with some of the most famous people in the world, because he had charge of all the sociology and anthropology articles that were issued, that were written for the encyclopedia. Everything went through his hands, and he was very happy that he was able to influence the materials in the encyclopedia, which, by the way, is still a marvelous document. Not the new one. The new one has been completely revised, but the old one, those 12 volumes. He started with volume 3. They had already got, were up to volume 3. This was a very fruitful time for him. He was very happy. It was really one of the periods of his life when he was exceedingly happy with what he was doing. He was happy in Washington, too, but our income was low, and he always felt that he would have to struggle very hard before he got anywhere. And in this case, he started out with a good income, and he felt very much a person who was recognized, you see. And so it was a very, an ideal situation for him. Now, as far as I was concerned, I was asked to work on the Daily Worker. So I worked on, it wasn't the Daily Worker. No.
The Labor Defender?
No, I was off the Labor Defender because a new editor had come in. I don't know who it was. I don't remember now what the problem was. But, at this time, these were the beginnings of trade union organization. And the Trade Union Unity Council was just being organized, and Foster Newman.
As dual unionism.
No, it wasn't dual unionism. It was an attempt to organize rank and file workers within the framework of the American Federation of Labor
So to be a caucus?
To be a caucus within the unions. There was no idea yet of a dual union. That came later. But in the beginning, it was just rank-and-file activity within the trade unions to press for unemployment insurance, to press for organization of the unorganized.
Okay, this is, we're making a correction now, and you should, this is the microphone, so you should talk into that.
There was never any question about dual unionism. Foster's hope was to organize the unorganized within the existing trade union movement, which was the American Federation of Labor. We were labeled dual unionism. The unions that were finally organized through the efforts of the rank and file and were not yet admitted to the American Federation of Labor were labeled dual unions, although the objective was eventually to join forces with the basic trade union movement of the time.
Well, what about the Trade Union Unity League?
The Trade Union Unity League was, as is explained here, the Trade Union Unity Council was a New York local of the Trade Union Unity League. And the objectives which I have described are correct here, namely that we were concerned with raising the consciousness of the rank-and-file trade unionists so that they could create activity among their fellow workers to expand unionism, to organize the unorganized, to help the unemployed, and to carry through a more progressive program AFL leaders who were stodgy and backward and politically reactionary.
But you weren't thinking of starting any new union like the IWW or the...
No, we had never had that objective. But we did have to organize separate unions because of the antagonism and the backwardness of the AFL, which would not accept the idea of new workers coming in as separate unions,
the AFL itself was really an elitist organization that wanted to limit its membership to the skilled, and the idea of organizing unskilled workers was to them an obnoxious one, and therefore they did not sympathize with what we were doing. In fact, they tried to interfere with what we were doing and to obstruct our efforts. And we had to organize the unskilled workers in this way because there was no other possibility of getting them to organize a union. And then our objective was, of course, to consolidate them into the established trade union framework.
And they also didn't organize women or blacks.
No, their attitude, of course, towards any of the workers of the time that were not in the union. For instance, they were very antagonistic to the idea of organizing even the lumber workers, who were a powerful group, because they simply didn't fit into their framework. Anything that was outside the established, limited AFL international unions was to them abhorrent. They could not bear the thought of bringing in outside elements.
A continuation of the first tape.
On the level of the broader issues confronting the American workers.
And the Communist Party had a lot to do with it.
Well, Foster, who was a leader of the Communist Party, was the head of the Trade Union Unity Council. That's what we called it. And this was the beginning of the embryonic unions that were formed later that became part of the CIO. Yeah. But at this time, they had committees. And they were organizing. They had a hotel and restaurant organizing committee. They had an electrical workers organizing committee, a transport workers organizing committee. They were small committees of progressive rank and file trade unionists who wanted to push for organization of the unorganized. And then there were rank and file committees within the AFL who wanted to push the AFL leadership into a broader program. So there were two aspects of this program. At this time, the Hotel and Restaurant Organizing Committee, which was made up of some very very energetic, excellent people, were doing very well, and they needed an editor for a newspaper. They had enough money to have a newspaper, and it was then that I was suggested to edit the Hotel and Restaurant Workers. Do you need that light? Hotel and Restaurant Workers, I think they called it the Food Worker.
That's right.
And it was a general newspaper reporting the activities of all the various food unions in the country and in New York City, and also propagandizing for organization of the unorganized and the need for a union and why and where for the conditions in the industry, all of that sort of thing. So I worked with them, with the Food Workers Organizing Committee, and I edited.
Stopped working with the Labor Defender.
I stopped working with the Labor Defender, and this time I took on a paid job as the editor of the Food Worker.
And you stopped working because a new editor came on that you didn't get along with?
No. I was just filling in at the time. I was just helping out, and there was I don't remember even what the problems were, but I never looked upon this as a permanent job. The International Labor Defender. I was just a volunteer that was working in a place where I was needed, and that was all. And so I never considered that particularly important. But the Food Worker meant a lot to me, and I worked very hard on that. And then I became pregnant. And during this
on
period...
On purpose.
What?
On purpose.
Well, I had had a child. I had been pregnant in Washington and lost the first baby. Also, a stillbirth.
Oh,
just like my mother. My mother had three stillbirths, and I don't know. We never have been able to figure out what the reason for it was, except because I carried the child to term. I was very healthy, but I did
and
have
had checkups and everything.
I had wonderful. I had an excellent obstetrician, one of the best in Seattle, recommended by my brother-in-law, who was an allergist and who knew all the people that were, you know, anybody in all these various. He was in the allergy society, and they had contacts with all these other people, all these physicians everywhere. And he was the one who suggested this obstetrician as one of the outstanding people on the West Coast. And my obstetrician tried a new method, which was popularly called twilight sleep, but was an anesthetic, a spinal anesthetic, which he said he had used on 80 patients. And because I had expressed the fears that my mother had instilled in me about childbirth, you know, because my mother talked about her terrible experiences in childbirth all the time. So I had evidently, when I became pregnant in Seattle, worried about what my mother had told me. And I My mother was in Seattle. And I had conveyed these fears to the doctor as well as to my husband. And the doctor was aware of this, of the psychological aspects of this. And he tried to lessen my fears by telling me that this particular spinal anesthetic would not inhibit labor pains, but the labor pains would go on, but I would not have any problems with pain or anything. That it would work so that I would have a very easeful childbirth. He never anticipated a cesarean, and of course when I went into labor, pains were very very severe. And he administered the spinal anesthetic, and for 24 hours after that, I had no labor pains, and I had very severe pains, but not labor pains. There was no contraction, see. And apparently, it didn't work in my case. I still think that I probably had a frigid pelvis, and I should have had a cesarean. But he had so much
faith. Maybe the child died because of not being born.
Well, that's it. It had struggled so to be to be born. But that when it was finally born, it had no. I don't remember what it was, but the respiration was gone. There was nothing there. The child was dead. So, of course, that was kind of a shock to both of us. And but the doctor had said to me,
"Was it a girl?"
It was a girl. Yeah. The doctor said at that time, if you can, become pregnant as soon as possible, because your pelvis has been inflated. You are now, it's more easeful. You may have no trouble whatsoever. And it proved to be right. So as soon as Bernard had a position.
Did you get the dates, by the way?
The dates of what?
Of the food worker.
No, I didn't get the dates.
You see, that is something that I think I have to have in order to be clear about because, you know, later I came back and I was educational director of the
food worker
of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, which was started by the Food Workers Organizing Committee, you see.
We could get that from the Tenement Library, the years.
Yes.
I could go over and get it because I live very near.
I'm very fuzzy about the years in which I worked. But I think, I'm quite sure because I remember that I was on the picket line when I was pregnant. So I know that it was during my pregnancy that I worked there.
So that it would be what year? So it would be 19...
Well, it would be 19...
28?
I was born in 31, so it was 31.
31.
Yeah, would be the whole year from 31.
Okay.
I became pregnant in September 1930, and I worked straight through until the seventh month. And they kept me off the picket line because they said I might get hurt from the horse cops, you know, were coming along. And
right.
And I had to be there because I had a report, you see. So I had to be on the picket line to see what was going on. I was a reporter as well.
So did you take a leave of absence or?
I don't remember what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did.
Took a leave and then returned to it.
Oh, I know. I think somebody else was replaced. They knew I had to leave and they knew I had to give birth, so they replaced me with somebody. In fact, I think Joe North was the...
Joe North was your replacement?
But I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
I'm not absolutely sure. I'd have to look at those issues again.
Okay, now we're going to continue with the original tape.
Yeah. What's happened?
Original tape is not continued.
Union, and they all thought
what were they picketing for? To get organized?
They were picketing against injunctions. The injunction situation.
Okay. Can we go back a little bit? Let's go back a little bit. This would drive me crazy.
I'm not very good at this.
I know, huh?
It had no... I don't remember what it was, but the respiration was gone, and there was nothing there. Charlie's dead. So, of course, that was kind of a shock to both of us. And but the doctor had said to me...
It was a girl?
It was a girl, yeah. The doctor said at that time, if you can, become pregnant as soon as possible, because your pelvis has been deeply inflated. You are now, it's more easeful. You may have no trouble whatsoever. And it proved to be right. So as soon as Bernard had a position with self.
What's that?
Workers Union, and they all thought
what
I was...
What were they picketing for? To get on?
Oh, now that's all been...
No, something happened there. I think maybe when you rang the bell, I did something wrong with the tape.
Oh,
so we'll have to... Right, it might have blotted it out. So if you could continue on becoming pregnant again with...
Yeah, but now I don't remember what happened.
Okay, then you became pregnant again.
That's right.
And this birth when you...
You were at, I think that there was something about the labor defender. You asked me again about the labor defender, and I said no, that it was only a temporary job that I had filled in because of need, that I never considered this a permanent permanent work for myself, that I was more interested in the labor movement and wanted very much to work with the unions or the organizing committees.
I think we did that already. What I think that was blotted out was just the birth of Mira, because it's just a very little part that was blotted out. And you said then you became pregnant again?
Yes. Then in September 1930, I became pregnant again, and Mira was born on June 1st, 1931.
And you didn't ask the party whether you could have a baby or not?
Indeed not. As a matter of fact, there were so few... women who were at that time giving birth to children in the movement, that when my colleagues in the food committee and in the food workers organizing committee learned of my pregnancy, they were all very delighted and treated me with great care and love and attention. And over and over again, towards the end, when my pregnancy was visible, and they tried to keep me off the picket lines and the activities that might endanger my health. There was one person in that committee whom I should like to record as one of the most dedicated and compassionate of men. He was Sam Cramberg, who died several years ago, and later, after the organizing committee had become a union, was for many years the leader of the Cafeteria Workers Union, a most intelligent, warm and loving person, who was greatly admired by the workers and respected.
For what specific skill? What specifically was so special about him? The way he organized,
his understanding of the workers' problems, his willingness to deal with them as individuals, his lack of a bureaucratic mien and attitude. He was always accessible to people. He never took the attitude that he was a leader, and yet he had fine leadership qualities.
Now, were people not having babies also because of the depression, because it was a depression?
Yes, I think that largely because there was absolutely no funds among the people who were in this activity. The party was filled with people who were unemployed and who were giving their time, perhaps in return for a cup of coffee and a donut during the day. There was no money. There were no funds for having children. And I was in an especially good position because my husband was now employed at a good salary, and we were comfortably situated. And it was a time for the child, for having children, because I was already now age 34.
Oh, right.
You see. And we were both aware of the fact that we didn't want to have children when we were
too old. Did also the party give birth control information to people?
No, they paid no attention to the individual, to individual personal life. As a matter of fact, in many respects, this became later an unhappy situation for many of us because we felt that we could never approach any party leader or any trade union leader with our personal problems, that they were totally alienated from the individual's problem. Mm. They were only interested in the social problem.
But even birth control as a social problem, they weren't interested in it?
No, there was absolutely no interest in
birth control.
Because
the Wobblies were really interested in birth control.
No, I had never heard any expression of interest. There was tolerance. There was an understanding that if you wanted to have birth control, that you had a right to it. But there was never any particular discussion of it or any
education.
No interest even on the part of the women who were in leadership positions, who were not leaders really, but who were in leadership positions. They were totally unconcerned with the individual problem.
Continuing with the original tape.
Yes.
They were picketing against injunctions. The injunction situation had developed to the point where if you put up a picket line, they would go to court, and the court would enjoin the union or the organizing committee, and then you couldn't picket. So they were going to break the injunctions, you see. And I wrote a pamphlet at that time called The Injunction Menace, which was published by Labor Research Association, in which I showed how this menace permeated all the organizing activities of labor everywhere, and that it was one of the methods by which they could repress the development of trade unionism. And it was a very good pamphlet, I thought. I don't even have it anymore. And it had a good impact on the workers. And then, of course, as the situation developed, as the organizing committees went out to try to organize cafeterias and restaurant dining rooms and places of that sort, they would go in and talk to the workers, and then they try to pull them out on strike.
So besides writing, you'd be on the spot covering the
right. Yes, that's right.
So you did a lot of activist work.
That's right. I was reporting as well as writing, you see, and I felt that I couldn't report it unless I went with them on the picket lines. And for a long time, especially when my pregnancy was showing, they would try to hold me back, you see, and they very often would say, you can't go to this because they're going to be men on horseback and they might run into you and you shouldn't do it. And one of my dearest friends was one of the organizers, Sam Cranberg, who's now dead, who sort of took it upon himself to be, took a fatherly interest in me. And when he saw that I was going out on the picket line, I was already in the seventh month, he said, I won't let you do it. I just won't let you do it. You can't go out. And he wouldn't let me go out. So. Mm-hmm. So I did that until I was stopped by the men.
Were most of the food and restaurant workers men?
Most of them, but there were a lot of women too.
Uh-huh.
We had waitresses and we had chambermaids, people who worked in hotels
as
well.
Was there anything about equalizing the men and women's pay?
No, there was no problem raised over equal pay because they were not yet even organized. Uh-huh. That was one of the their hopes, their goals, but it was not even mentioned because the main thing was to get a union, to get people into a union. And this went very slowly because of the repression. There was terrific repression. The police would break up picket lines. The courts would stop the unions. Workers were afraid. There were not many jobs, and they wanted to hold on to those jobs that they had. So, and there was a great deal of unemployment. There was always an unemployed line waiting when a worker would go off the job. They could easily break a strike by getting someone to come in to break the strike, you see. The scabs they didn't have any consciousness of trade unionism, so that the workers would go in and apply for jobs that the strikers had left. And this was a very serious problem for us. So the organization of the food workers was a rather slow process, but it went on. Until 1938, I think.
And you had a baby in
31.
At 34.
That's right.
Yeah,
I was late.
Yeah,
I was late.
Child, yeah.
Well, no, second child. See, I
right.
The second child. And this birth was very easy, just as the doctor had predicted. The baby was born 2 hours or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. It was just as easy as could be. So after that, of course, I felt I couldn't afford any more children, so I never did again become pregnant. But
And you stopped work in the seventh month?
I stopped work in the seventh month, but I was still doing things at home for them.
Uh-huh.
And by the time the baby was born, I had to give up work altogether. And when she was about,
So you gave up work totally?
Totally, yeah. But I only gave it up for a short time.
Oh.
By the time she was, how old was she? She was born in June. And by the following September, I was asked whether I would care to do part-time work on the daily worker.
Oh, so then she was 3 months old.
She was 3 months old.
Uh-huh. And Bernard was home.
And Bernard was home during, he wasn't home, he was working every day. He used to go in, we had a...
I want to make a correction here. Actually, I started part-time work on the daily worker in August.
So she was 2 months old.
Yes, about the middle of August.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was still living in Peekskill, we had a summer place there, and my mother was with me, and so she could take care of the baby when I left home, and I was rather eager to get back to work.